Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, September 25th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Palo Verde volunteer fire battles three fires in 24 hours. Eureka City Council Meet the Candidate series continues. And Congressman Huffman discusses bipartisan funding deal, Project 2025, and Middle East conflict escalation. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The Palo Verde Volunteer Fire Department experienced an unusually high volume of calls yesterday, responding to three incidents in less than 24 hours.
The fire department is the first line of defense for any wildland fire.
That was Megan Walsh, wildland firefighter, medical first responder, and public information officer with PVVFD.
Usually the calls are more spread out, but anything can happen in a day. And yesterday we definitely experienced high volume of calls for our local fire department.
The remote district is located 45 minutes southeast of Garberville, in the heart of the Emerald Triangle, where all three counties meet.
And that's the thing with Palo Verde Volunteer Fire Department. We respond to three different counties. So we respond to Humboldt, Mendocino, and Trinity counties. And it's a very large coverage area. And it's a lot when you get three calls in one day. So, yeah.
The causes of the Island, Mountain, and Scott fires remain under investigation. However, none of the fires grew beyond an acre in size. Despite this, responding to incidents throughout the district can be costly, and the funds needed to fuel the fire engines must be raised by the volunteers themselves.
Fundraising is a huge element of the volunteer fire department, and that is another reason why anyone in the community can give something, like whether it's money or time and energy to the department. They can definitely help with fundraising because the people that are out there in the field are already doing so much to try to make these fires go out and help save lives. But if you can offer any time or energy to fundraising, that helps the people in the field too. Local volunteer fire department is sustained on donations from the community.
The Palo Verde Volunteer Fire Department has a donation account at Vocality Community Credit Union, and their mailing address is listed on their social media page.
Yeah, the Palo Verde Volunteer Fire Department has a Facebook page, and that is where we're working to get information out about any kind of fire emergency, where we're asking people to stay off the road or be ready for evacuation. That's where we're trying to get the information out, is on Facebook.
You can stay up to date with the district by following the Palo Verde Volunteer Fire Department on Facebook. This week, KMUD News is hosting our Meet the Candidate series, where we feature interviews with those running for Eureka City Council. In Ward 2, incumbent Katie Moulton is being challenged by Kenny Carswell, currently employed as a project manager with Security National. In Ward 4, incumbent Scott Bauer is being challenged by Thavisak Lucky Simpenthong, a local business owner of Lucky Star Realty and the Eureka Skate Shop. Each candidate was given 15 minutes to share their platforms, and all were asked the same set of questions. Incumbents were asked to highlight their accomplishments during their time in office, while challengers were asked what inspired them to run. We are presenting the candidates in reverse alphabetical order by last name, giving you a comprehensive look at their priorities and vision for Eureka's future. Last night, we heard from Katie Moulton, who currently represents Ward 2. And tonight, we feature Kenny Carswell, who was vying for the Ward 2 seat.
So my name is Kenny Carswell. I am running for Eureka City Council Ward 2. Just a little bit about myself. I've been a lifelong resident of Eureka, California. I have lived in or just a few blocks away from Ward 2 for 28 of my 32 years. And my family has actually been living in Ward 2 and continues to live in Ward 2 since the 60s. So have some deep roots there. This is something that I've always wanted to do. I've kind of actually talked about it for quite a long time. And it's nice to have the support of friends and family, knowing this has always been an aspiration of mine. So I have a background in project management. But prior to that, I worked a lot of retail jobs around here in Eureka. So I know a ton of people, which I think will be helpful in getting things done. I have a lot of good relationships and have dealt with a lot of governmental and non-governmental entities on large projects. So I think that makes me well suited for this job.
Can you share what motivated you to run for office and what key accomplishments you hope to achieve if elected?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, I have a deep connection to Eureka and Ward 2. This is where I plan to retire. I love the area, beautiful people. I have had the opportunity to travel a little bit in my life, and I just love this place. I don't think you can beat Eureka and Humboldt County as a whole. So definitely inspired to just be a voice for the constituents here. I feel a strong sense of responsibility to give back to a city that's really given me everything. I've had a great life here. Like I said, a beautiful place, great people. I really just want to be a voice for the people of Ward 2 and ensure that their concerns are heard. And I just desire to bring some common sense solutions to the council. Want to see this place continue to grow and keep it beautiful and do everything that I can to basically make that happen.
What are the top five issues you would like to focus on? Are any of them specific to Ward 2? And can you explain why you believe you are better suited to address these issues compared to the incumbent?
So, I think there are several issues that are, you know, Ward 2 and citywide specific. So I think these five that I'm going to list to you are going to be applicable to both. So I'll start off with just wanting to make sure that the constituents are feeling heard. I'd like to bring about either some regularly scheduled town hall meetings like once a month, or even look into forming some sort of a committee for the ward, or at least my ward, but I think that all wards could benefit from that. So that would be my first concern. Second, housing is huge. I think that we need to focus on what's best for families. I've been doing a lot of door knocking here in these last few weeks, and I've heard a lot of concern from families about location and where their children feel safe to play and having access to open spaces. I think we need to think about that and take that into account. There is definitely areas of town that are better for, you know, working people or single people versus families. So I think that's an important distinction. I also think that it's important for us to continue to work on transitional housing for the mentally ill. I think that's important. I think our homeless crisis here as well, we need to work on providing them good housing options. And I'm open to any and all suggestions on that and working on a few ideas of my own as well. Another problem, I would like to do something to bolster our tax base. Our city is in a $1.1 million deficit. This is mainly due to just flat sales tax revenues. So I would like to do stuff to usher in new business and support and promote our local businesses that are here now, and also promote tourism. That transient occupancy tax is huge. It's a good moneymaker that goes directly into infrastructure projects in our city. So tourism, or that basically is what fills up those hotel rooms for the most part. So anything we can do to continue to support our local tourism industry and make Eureka more welcoming to businesses to come here. Another thing, I think that right now we're going through a problem with job retention and recruitment for our public safety officials. Our average salary here is below state average. We're losing firefighters and police officers to other departments. We need to bolster our plan and have basically something that can compete with other similar cities that we're losing these public servants to. From the conversations that I've had, we need to discuss workload, salary, and their benefits to stay competitive. Then the final point that I'm going to plug here, we need to work on offerings for our people with mental health problems. You know, I drive around town and I think we all just need to look at this through a lens of empathy, that that's somebody's family member out there, you know, their child, brother, sister, mother, father. These people need help. So I'd like to seek funding opportunities for programs new and existing. We do have a lot of good existing programs working. I'd like to collaborate with mental health professionals here locally and outside of the area. There's a lot of programs that are doing good that we haven't tapped into quite yet here locally. And then I think that there's a big part of educating the public on this and getting them involved in seeing a change here locally.
Our final question is in regards to Measure F, the Citizens Initiative to amend Eureka's general plan, a prominent issue on this year's ballot. Could you share your thoughts on this measure, whether you support it or not, and please explain your reasoning?
So Measure F is going to be voted in the same election that I am. Personally, the aspect of it that I support is providing both parking and housing in the Old Town area. And that kind of goes back to the point I made about supporting our businesses here and also tourism. But that aside, my main goal is to work with the constituents of Ward 2 to see what they want there, whether Measure F passes or not.
And finally, before we wrap up, do you have any closing remarks or final thoughts you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I just want people to know that I'm going to be very accessible. I want to be able to be reached either phone or email. I want to hear their concerns. I want to work on those in a collaborative approach and do what the constituents are wanting us to do. I want to be a conduit for that on the council. And if elected, that's my main directive. Being born and raised in Eureka, I just want to help my fellow citizen and help them feel heard. And, you know, I want to take a team approach on this. And I think we can do great things to an already great city.
Again, that was Kenny Carswell running for Eureka City Council Ward 2, which is located in the northern part of the city. Ward 2 includes a mix of residential neighborhoods, commercial areas, and community spaces. It encompasses parts of Old Town, known for its historic architecture, small businesses, and waterfront areas, as well as newer developments and key city landmarks. Local issues in the ward include housing, economic development, and infrastructure improvements, making it a focal point for many of the city's discussion on growth and revitalization. You can join us the rest of this week on Thursday and Friday to hear from the Ward 4 candidates, incumbent Scott Bauer and challenger Thavisak Lucky Simpenthong. You can find all of these interviews archived on our SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/KMUD News. In national news, KMUD got an opportunity to speak with our representative for the North Coast, Congressman Jared Huffman, in this interview. Good afternoon, Congressman Huffman, and thank you for joining us. It has been a very busy day as Congress just reached that bipartisan funding agreement. So I'm hoping we can begin today by sharing an overview on how we are going to avoid a government shutdown.
Thanks, Lauren. Look, it wasn't pretty. It never is in this Congress. We've just seen one sort of standoff and brinksmanship exercise after another, from the debt ceiling manufactured crisis to other threats of government shutdowns. And so it continued with this latest funding deadline, with Speaker Johnson and House Republicans threatening to shut down the government unless they got this legislation they call the SAVE Act, which would have made people jump through hoops to demonstrate citizenship before being allowed to vote in the election. Once they realized that they didn't even have the votes on their side to pass that, they capitulated and looked to Democrats, as they always do, to provide the votes to fund the government. And we did that on a clean resolution that'll fund the government through December 20th. I'm not proud of any of this, but at least the lights are going to stay on and we can get through the election without that spectacle.
Will the work need to continue through the lame duck session?
Yeah, so the lame duck session will begin right after the election. We will come back the following week, and there's actually a lot of work because, if you haven't noticed, this has been a deeply unproductive Congress. So the defense authorization is backed up. The farm bill is backed up. There are other end-of-year deadlines for major bills that are expiring. And, you know, we have only a temporary patch for to fund the government through next October 1st. So all of that has to happen in a period of just a few weeks. And that's what we call the lame duck session.
Yesterday, you joined House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries for a hearing where you highlighted your own investigation into Project 2025. What are some of those key findings you've uncovered?
The main thing I think we brought to the conversation was testimony from real people who have experienced some of these extreme policies in states where, for example, one of the Trump abortion bans became law. Wisconsin, people from Florida, Georgia. So it is different when you hear from people whose lives have been impacted. We heard from one, we heard the story about a woman in Georgia who died because of one of these extreme, no exception abortion bans. And so we wanted to really bring the extremism of Project 2025 to life through that testimony. And we talked about some other ways in which, you know, people's livelihoods, workers who stand to lose overtime pay, struggling families who are going to watch, you know, the changes to mortgage policy and healthcare policy and other things that will mean thousands of dollars out of their pockets while the Project 2025 plan would give away billions and billions in tax cuts to the rich. So I think just making it real, making it relatable for people through these stories and through that testimony was really helpful.
You actually co-founded the task force looking into this, and you shared a video during the hearing. It's also posted to your socials. It outlines some of the pillars of the project, and you specifically called out the fourth pillar. Can you elaborate on what makes that especially alarming?
Right. So, you know, the main thing is the 922-page manifesto that everybody knows about because they published it on the internet, and, you know, you can Google it right now and read it for yourself. The other pillars are a personnel database that they've told us about, but they haven't, you know, shown it to us. But we know that there are thousands and thousands of Trump loyalists that are in this database looking for work in the federal government once they purge tens of thousands of civil service workers throughout government. So this is deep politicization of the federal workforce that is very controversial. And then this training academy, you get into the database once you've completed this sort of boot camp for MAGA extremists. But then you get to the fourth pillar. And this is one where they acknowledge the existence of an early action plan. This is the executive orders and emergency declarations and things that would roll out literally within hours or days of Trump taking the oath of office. But they won't tell us what's in it. It is completely secret. And they, you know, haven't published it. We've written them letters asking about it. They have refused to respond. The only thing we know for sure is that the head of Heritage, Kevin Roberts, said in an interview that this stuff is so controversial that they can't share it with the public.
Speaking of Kevin Roberts, you mentioned him and Russ Vaught in your video. Can you explain to our listeners how you have observed their influence among colleagues?
Yeah, these are not like random think tank personnel that nobody knows. These are folks who my Republican colleagues go on their radio shows. They're folks who, you know, count themselves as close personal friends with many of the MAGA Republicans in Congress. And some of my Republican colleagues will give speeches on the House floor praising Kevin Roberts, for example, the primary architect of Project 2025.
What comes next for the task force, and how much is riding on this election?
Yeah, well, what's left is we will continue to do a lot of messaging. We have spent the last few months doing two things. One, telling people what's in Project 2025, and two, having a series of really deep substantive briefings so that members of Congress could get much smarter about some of the more technical aspects of Project 2025 so that we can go, you know, into deep conversations on podcasts and, you know, media appearances that are not just quick sound bites. And the final piece of our work are these public-facing hearings. We had one that got a lot of attention this week, and my hope is that there will be at least two more that happen in other parts of the country. We need to take the show on the road. And the best way to stop Project 2025, of course, is to stop it at the ballot box. The American people have the ability to put an end to this. Of course, you know, if Democrats do win the election, we will have some work to do because we're going to need to legislate some backstops against this agenda ever coming back. But that is a much better place to be than on the losing end of an election where the only thing we have to do is kind of brace for impact and lawyer up and hope we get some relief in the courts.
Before we run out of time, I want to turn to the Middle East, as there's been significant escalation. Can you share your understanding of what's going on, and how much influence does the United States have to de-escalate?
I know the U.S., that the Biden-Harris administration is trying very hard to de-escalate here. That is not an easy thing to do because Hezbollah and Israel have been in pretty much of a hot war now for many months. You've got tens of thousands of people in northern Israel that have had to evacuate and no longer live in that region of the country. And we know that Israel has launched a whole bunch of strikes in response to the missiles that are coming over from Hezbollah. So, you know, this looks a lot like war at this point. And what we hope is that it won't escalate into a full-scale war. Hezbollah still has tens of thousands of medium-range missiles that can do a lot of damage. And there are a lot of innocent people in harm's way. You know, when we talk about Lebanon, I'm sure that most of the regular Lebanese citizenry aren't thrilled about the fact that these Iranian-backed terrorists have taken over the southern end of their country. They're victims to Hezbollah as much as Israel is. But we don't want this to escalate into a full war between Israel and Hezbollah, and we don't want it to escalate into a regional conflict that would, you know, bring in Iran, because at that point, this gets very scary for the entire region and has the potential to even spread beyond that.
As per usual, we covered a lot. Anything else you would like to leave us with today, Congressman Huffman?
I think that's it. We are just a few weeks out from what surely is the most important election in the past century. And I just thank you for giving me a chance to speak to the issues and help keep folks educated. And I hope everybody's registered and ready to get out there and vote.
Again, that was our representative for the North Coast, Congressman Jared Huffman, speaking to me earlier this afternoon from Washington, D.C. If you have a question you would like asked, you can submit it to news@kmud.org. President Joe Biden delivered his final speech to the UN. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Today is the fourth time I've had the great honor of speaking to this assembly as President of the United States. It'll be my last.
President Joe Biden addressed the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday with a speech that described a host of problems facing the world, but also accomplishments that give him hope for the future.
I know many look at the world today and see difficulties and react with despair, but I do not. I won't. As leaders, we don't have the luxury.
He listed challenges like wars in Ukraine, Gaza, and Sudan, hunger, climate crisis, and the risk and promise of artificial intelligence. He quoted Irish poet William Butler Yeats, who wrote back in 1919, "Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world." But, Biden says, in our time, the center has held.
There'll always be forces that pull our countries apart and the world apart. Aggression, extremism, chaos, and cynicism. A desire to retreat from the world and go it alone. Our test, is to make sure that the forces holding us together are stronger than those that are pulling us apart. That the principles of partnership that we came here each year to uphold can withstand the challenges. That the center holds once again.
He described positive achievements, some his own, like passing the Violence Against Women Act and ending America's longest war by withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. He described a commitment of $500 million to help Afghan countries respond to the outbreak of Mpox, and he reaffirmed U.S. commitments to Ukraine and to Israel's defense. He also talked about his decision to withdraw from the upcoming presidential election, even though, he says, there is so much more I want to get done.
As much as I love the job, I love my country more. I decided after 50 years of public service, it's time for a new generation of leadership to take my nation forward. My fellow leaders, let us never forget, some things are more important than staying in power.
He ended his speech with his usual optimism, saying we're stronger than we think, and what people call impossible is just an illusion.
My fellow leaders, there is nothing that's beyond our capacity if we work together. Let's work together. God bless you all, and may God protect all those who seek peace. Thank you.
Biden delivered his remarks at the opening debate of the United Nations General Assembly's 79th session. Over 6 days, the Assembly will hear from 76 heads of state, 42 heads of government, 2 crown princes, and others. But as the UN Secretary General's office points out, of those 194 scheduled speakers, only 19 are women. Secretary General Antonio Guterres himself opened the General Assembly with a speech part dire warning and part call to action.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, our world is in a whirlwind.
He talked about deepening geopolitical divisions, a planet that keeps heating, wars raging with no sign of an end, as we edge toward a powder keg that risks engulfing the world.
I stand before you in this whirlwind convinced of two overriding truths. First, the state of our world is unsustainable. We can't go on like this. And second, the challenges we face are solvable. But that requires us to make sure the mechanisms of international problem solving actually solve problems.
He says there are 3 factors driving instability. First, a world of impunity, where some countries, he says, thumb their nose at international law and the UN Charter. Second, a world of inequality. And third, a world of uncertainty. Like Biden, he ranged widely, talking about wars in Gaza and Ukraine, a humanitarian crisis in Sudan, rising terrorism in the Sahel region of Africa, and on to Myanmar, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, Yemen, all while, he says, the UN's peacekeeping missions operate in areas where there is no peace to keep.
We are moving to a multipolar world, but we are not yet there yet. We are in a purgatory of polarity. And in this purgatory, more and more countries are filling the spaces of geopolitical divides, doing whatever they want with no accountability.
Guterres, like Biden, emphasized the importance of international law in the UN Charter. As they were speaking, another UN body was also meeting. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was on hand at the UN Security Council, where he talked about the war with Russia.
Every day, Ukrainians are wounded and killed every day. Today, once again, Russian bombs hit residential buildings. Even an ordinary bread factory became a target. What's so threatening to Russia about making bread?
He said that war will not fade away, and Russian President Vladimir Putin has broken too many international rules to stop on his own. But like President Biden, Zelensky had his own optimism.
One day in this hall, it will surely be said that Russia's war against Ukraine has ended, not frozen, not paused, not forgotten, truly ended. And this will happen not because someone got tired of the war, not because someone traded something with Putin. Russia's war against Ukraine will end because the UN Charter will work.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporter, Christopher Martinez. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.